And if you think about what philosophy provides for us is a construct and frameworks for figuring out who we are, which is where our true value comes from. Our true value as human beings comes from not what we do, but from who we are, how we show up, and how we simply connect and exist in communion with our fellow travelers called human beings.
Welcome to the inaugural episode of Wisdom at Work, Philosophy Beyond the Ivory Tower, where I interview people who translate philosophy into successful careers outside the academy, to tell their stories, how they found their way through the wilderness and reinvented themselves, and distill the insights, the decisions, the strategies, the books, the tips, and the secrets to their success. If you're new to the podcast, I would recommend checking out the trailer and episode zero, where I go into the background, the rationale, and the goals of the podcast. If you're interested in what I like to call people's Batman Begins stories, how they became who they are professionally, how they got their big break, how they found their success. If you are an undergrad considering declaring a philosophy major, or a graduating senior with a philosophy major, wondering what the hell you're going to do with that major. If you're a master's student in philosophy, if you are a PhD in philosophy, if you are an academic, maybe even a full professor, and are looking for some outside-the-box, unconventional ways to apply your career, whether that is as a hobby, as a side gig, or maybe even as a career transition, then I think you're going to find a lot of value in these interviews. My guest today is Sal Giambanco. Sal is a former executive at PayPal, eBay, and the Omidyar Network, a philanthropic investment firm founded by Pierre Omidyar, the creator of eBay. Sal is a human capital expert, an executive coach, and as he described to me upon our first meeting around 10 years ago, a philosophical counselor for CEOs. This is a very special episode, not just because it's the first, but because I've known for a long time that I wanted Sal to be my first guest, in large part because in some ways he's the reason why this podcast exists at all. As you'll see in our conversation, my meeting him was very serendipitous and really opened my eyes and changed my mind about what people with a philosophical background, training, and sensibility are capable of achieving professionally and the kind of impact that they can have. I think Sal is a great example of someone who's been very successful in conventional terms, but in a very unconventional way. This is a two-part episode. We ended up going for over 3 hours. And so this is a very wide-ranging conversation, touching on everything from Sal growing up in the Bronx to how he entered and subsequently left the Jesuits and had an extraordinary career. You will hear about how he came to find himself as one of the first group of Westerners invited for a meal in the Dalai Lama's kitchen, how he advised Pope Francis at the Vatican, and his advice for his friend Elon Musk. As you'll see from the episode, Sal has an incredible and eclectic mind. I remember when I was talking with Joe McShane, the president of Fordham University, who was actually close friends with Sal, and he said, "Oh my God, Sal Giambanco, that guy's mind moves a mile a minute." And you will see that very much on display. If you'd like to support the podcast and help it grow, there are a number of things that you could do. First of all, you could share with a friend or family member, a classmate or a colleague. Share it on your socials. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Or subscribe and maybe write a short review on iTunes. If you'd like to leave feedback, if there are topics you'd like to see covered, or if you'd like to recommend a guest or be a guest, drop me a line on our website, www.davidestory.com. And now, without further ado, I give you my wide-ranging conversation with Mr. Sal Giambanco. Sal, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. David.
So where are we speaking to you from?
I'm in Provincetown this morning.
Oh, nice.
Massachusetts. It's on the tip of Cape Cod, and it's actually A lot of Americans don't know this. It's where the Pilgrims first landed, actually. Before heading to Plymouth Rock, they actually have some settlements here, but could not find reliable sources of water. So they packed up and went to Plymouth Rock.
Okay. Yeah. We were just chatting before I started recording. I didn't realize we were going to be so close. Ideally, we could do it in person, but this is good enough. So I am so excited for this conversation. In some ways, I feel like I've been looking forward to this for 10 years. I actually did the math earlier today, and I realized we have known each other for almost 10 years.
Wow. That's pretty exciting.
Very exciting. And I knew that you were going to be my first guest for the podcast for a number of reasons, but one of which is that I think the idea for this whole project really started because we met. And because of an idea, a seed you planted in my head at a very crucial time. Just to give listeners some background, Sal and I met in 2008. And I remember that not only because it became an important relationship for me, but it was also right on the eve of the election, the historic election of Barack Obama. And it was right on the cusp of the crash of 2008. And that is important context because I met Sal when I was about halfway done with my dissertation, very much in the deepest part of the underworld on the hero's journey of the PhD, and about to go in the job market, and job market was terrible. And then the crash, you know, things got even worse. And I'm like, what the hell am I doing with my life? I've made a huge mistake and so on. And I was walking home from the library on Fordham campus one day, and I kind of stumbled into this lecture that was how to translate your liberal arts background into a career in the private sector. And there was four undergraduates, and the person running the program, and me. But the speaker turned out to be one of the most captivating speakers and people I'd ever encountered, and it was you. And we stayed in touch, and you were became a helpful mentor figure for me as I was, you know, trying to get my sea legs professionally. And we stayed in touch ever since. So, but the things that we talked about were what else could philosophers do, or people with a philosophical mindset or background.
Audience should also know that you're both very kind, and you're also very talented and very creative, very innovative. In fact, if I were to call you anything, it would probably be a philosophical entrepreneur.
All right, I'll take it. Thank you. I want to start with traveling. I know you travel for something like 40% of the year. How much of your time do you still spend traveling?
So now that I'm actually in a my partner doesn't like me to use the R word, but I'm in a kind of semi-retirement part of my life right now. Mm-hmm. If I can quote one of the best CEOs I ever worked for, Meg Whitman, Meg used to say that you should only be at one place for about 10 years, maximum 10 years at one place. And because you need a couple of things. One, no matter how good we are in our role, we can get stale. Number two, change always keeps us fresh and actually reawakens whatever's going on inside of ourselves. And I'll add a third, which is we make room for the next generation. If you think about it, 10 years is a half a generation. And it's really, really important to get out of the way, regardless of what we've accomplished. I think it's really, really important to get out of the way and to let the next generation take over, whether that's in thought, whether that's in social change, justice, whether that's in leading a business forward into its next stage of growth. Mm-hmm. And so this is a great example where it's very important after 10 years at the Omidyar Network. I did about 10 years at PayPal and eBay, 10 years at the Omidyar Network. I did actually around 10 years at the Jesuits. The Jesuits. And if you think about that, it's really time to let folks like yourself, right? You're coming into your own now in terms of thinking about this podcast, thinking about all the topics you're weaving together. These are things that might have been some random ideas or random seeds that some of us were talking about 20, 30 years ago, but you're actually doing it. And that's what I find so exhilarating and inspirational about this generation. Most folks have, I think, are disrespectful to millennials. I think they're disrespectful to the
Definitely.
And the younger generation is the most globally conscious generation, I think, in human history. And your generation is leading the world forward. And I just want to say thank you.
Yeah. Well, we'll try. But I mean, I think that is such a good point about millennials. And I really resent that too, because I teach them and I spend, you know, more time with them than probably most people do, you know, rather than, you know, your children, if you have children, millennials. But even if some of those, you know, caricatures are true, like, you raise them. it's really the older generations criticizing themselves unconsciously, even if those accusations are true.
That's a very good point. And I might point out that it's my generation. I'm on the tail end of the baby boomers. The baby boomers may be the most selfish generation in history in terms of the havoc it reached, the havoc my generation has wrought with our institutions, with our infrastructure, with creating a unsustainable consumerist society, and with creating an American exceptionalism, which is dangerous for the world.
Mm. This point you mentioned from Meg Whitman, in your own life, was that something that you were intentionally doing, or is that in retrospect you look back and every 10 years or so, was there sort of an internal alarm that went off of it's time to move on?
That's a great question. And I wish I could claim to be more mindful, but I can't. I do think it was, when I look back on it, there was, in each one of those times after each segment, there was, at the time I didn't recognize it. In fact, at the time I would say it felt like a crisis in each case. In some cases, it felt there was a level I would probably say at the time that felt involuntary. But when I look back on it, in each case, greatest blessing, and consistent with my own thoughts and ideas, as I said, Meg's idea on this, which I think is correct. But it's easier to think it than to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Much easier to have the concept than to actually live it, because in each case, there's a grieving process and there's a letting go process, right, and there's a growth process that frankly is hard to go through. Whenever mm-hmm. we have transitions are hard and they're stressful, but they create opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine too, one reason maybe that it's harder at the feeling level is that there's a very strong counterforce, which is the fear mm-hmm. of the unknown. And that my identity is so wrapped up in this role and being this XYZ that noise is too loud and it drowns out the other feeling, which is the deeper desire where I know that I need to move on, but I'm afraid to.
On that point, I couldn't agree more with that point. The only color I would add is that it's in many ways the classical challenge for men who self-identify by what we do as opposed to who we are. And if you think about what philosophy provides for us is a construct and frameworks for figuring out who we are, which is where our true value comes from. Our true value as human beings comes from not what we do, but from who we are, how we show up, and how we simply connect and exist in communion with our fellow travelers called human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very important point, but it's hard, right? It's hard to recognize that I make myself vulnerable and I have to give up control and power, which our culture wants us to pursue, but mm-hmm. in fact are illusions.
Yeah. So connecting this with what you said earlier about every 10 years moving on and how that's healthy for institutions and for society as a whole, if more institutions are, you know, people moving through institutions are on that timeline. People often say today, young people now will have, you know, six careers or so, you know, rather than, you know, one or two careers. And I'm wondering if you think that combined with more and more women being in positions of leadership might lead to a sort of shift of consciousness where people become less attached to their role and what they do, because what they do is changing more frequently and more who they are, such that who they are is infusing more into their work and into, you know, the social space in general. I could just see that you know, only being a positive thing.
I would completely agree with that, and you really said it so eloquently. And I would just make a plug for the empowerment of women. We know from our I know from my own work that when we empower women, particularly in the developing world, they do something amazing. They educate their daughters. And once we have two generations that do that, we end poverty. In March of 2013, The Economist had, I would say, a groundbreaking issue in which it devoted itself to looking at the issues of poverty. And I think even though it's 5 years old, I think it's still relevant today, their work in that, the work at The Economist. That work indicated that we really do have the ability to, if we put our collective minds to it, to eliminate poverty globally today. There is no reason why any woman should not have access to health care. And there's no reason why children, both in this country and globally, should not have access to food, shelter, clothing, education, and the unleashing of their true human potential.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that, you know, increased education of women and girls, that also starts to deal with one aspect of the climate problem as well, which is lowering fertility rates, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good thing, right? I mean, yeah. I'm one of those people who recognizes that, you know, we have about 7 billion people on the planet today. We are headed to 9 billion over the next 10 or 15 years. And then potentially upwards of 11 billion, and then it's expected to stabilize. But we have a lot of work to do in order to reach a planet with all of its systems that can support that level of population. So I think we're again, your generation is going to be really leading the planet forward, despite the hiccup in Washington we're experiencing right now.
Well, hiccup, understatement of the the zag. I come to calling it the zag, along with President Obama.
Well, remember, it's very important to remember folks like Martin Luther King and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who I have had the good fortune of knowing for almost 30 years. And Desmond Tutu, who is still alive, he's probably the greatest, in my mind, greatest moral thinker of our time, reminds us that the arc of history bends towards justice. And if we look at the promise of one of my favorite countries in the world, South Africa, and you have an incredible experiment on unfolding in front of our eyes, where you had true leadership in the form of Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu, who created a constitution, the first constitution in the world that was was entirely inclusive. A lot of folks don't realize that it was the South African Constitution in 1994 that is the first constitution in the world that actually includes gay men and gay women and gay marriage in the Constitution. And that was a tribute from Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela, who had a son who also passed away from HIV. And so when you look at Nelson Mandela's incredible context of suffering, he translated that suffering into a social justice model that I think every one of us should be cheering for its success. Because I do believe that South Africa is a beacon for the world in terms of how you can actually create a society in which you have a true multiracial society living in harmony. Now, it has a lot of challenges, but I think all of us should be pulling for South Africa to succeed, because we're going to find, I think, that more innovation, more ingenuity will be coming from the developing world. It's already starting. We have things like frugal innovation coming out of places like Bangladesh and India. I always remind folks that Bangladesh created the world's largest and most successful NGO in BRAC, and that's according to Forbes. And I do think that those of us in the West have to kind of get off our arrogant perch and recognize that there's a lot that is happening in the developing world. There's a lot that is going on in the developing world, and the true leadership of the planet will probably be coming from the developing world over the next 20, 30, 40 years. In 50 years, less than that, about 40 years, one out of every two young people will be African. So as we head to the second half of the 21st century, it will be the African century. And Africa will be responsible for leading the world. And I may be the first person on your podcast that reminds folks that if we look at the demographics, we will have a second half African century.
Well, you're definitely the first person on the podcast to say that, in part because you're the first person on the podcast. but we'll hold the prediction. So speaking of South Africa and Mandela, I don't know, did you watch Obama's speech?
It was extraordinary.
It was. I watched the whole thing, all 1 hour, 28 minutes of it. It was his first, for those of you listening who haven't seen it, I would highly recommend watching the whole thing, not just the excerpts and highlights. In part because it wasn't just what he said, it was the whole context. One thing that, and it was his first publicized speech since leaving office. And one of the things that struck me was they kept panning to the audience. And there were so many of these young, bright faces looking up at him. And I was trying to think, what is going through their minds right now? Because he is talking to the future. And he knows it. And it made everything that has been going on in Washington seem so small. Mm-hmm. And such a blip. And one of the things that I always loved about Obama was he never lost sight of the long game. One eye was always on the big picture of, you know, he thought not just in decades, but in centuries. And I think that's one reason people responded to him. But your framing of these issues is very refreshing, I have to say, because so many people I talk to are so pessimistic about things, both in America and globally, with climate change and, you know, the rise of populism and nationalism and all this stuff. So your predictions and your outlook are very refreshing, and I think we'll probably come back to some of this in more detail later when we get to your work with the Omidyar Network.
Well, you know, when you talk about pessimism and optimism, I think it's one of the most important things we can talk about, because it's directly related to philosophy, it's directly related to how we think about this concept of happiness, it's directly related to who am I and how do I want to live my life. And how do I choose to participate in this life? Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to recognize that Americans, historically an optimistic people, we have never been as pessimistic as we are today. Mm. And the most amazing thing for me is the how optimistic folks are, particularly the younger generation, in places like Africa and India. It's remarkably optimistic. And as you said, taking the long view of history is extremely important, because anything we're experiencing, even our own lives, are merely blips in the context of history. And much like, it's really important for what you do, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank all teachers, because as you said, Barack Obama was planting the seeds, and he was looking at the future, and every teacher touches the future. And it's an incredibly noble profession, because if we want to change the future, that's how we do it. Lastly, in terms of the social justice issues, I would say the person who is probably closest to Nelson Mandela in the United States today is probably Bryan Stevenson over at the Equal Justice Initiative. And Bryan Stevenson, it's in fact the tagline of every email I write, when asked about how do we achieve social justice, he said, there are four things required. Number one, we need to be proximate. Number two, we need to change the narrative. Number three, we need to be hopeful. And number four, we need to be uncomfortable, because social justice change affects all of us. And I think that's probably the most important advice I can give to anyone who may be perplexed or may be full of anxiety based on climate change and what's happening in Washington, the political scene. We have to remember that the news cycle and the news media itself is a corporate business. It's been more corporatized in my lifetime than we've had in many years in the United States. And so I believe in the media. I believe in the Fourth Estate, absolutely. But at the same time, we have to recognize that it can actually have an impact on our soul, our spirit. And we have to remember that we if we really want to affect change, it starts when we open our front door. And how do we greet our neighbor? And where do we see the injustices literally in our neighborhood? Washington is so far away from all of us. And so we do, and they win, I tell everyone. The forces of darkness win whenever we get upset, whenever we become full of anxiety. Mm-hmm. When we practice kindness and compassion and empathy, and we actually open our door and we are compassionate to those who are suffering around us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about this podcast yesterday, and when I woke up yesterday morning, one of the great Jewish philosophers, Jewish Catholic philosophers of the 20th century came to mind, and that, of course, is Edith Stein. And Edith Stein, yesterday was the anniversary of her death at Auschwitz and in 1942. And Edith Stein is really important. She's one of these figures that reminds us it's amazing that almost 100 years ago, she wrote her dissertation on empathy. Her dissertation is actually on how we think about empathy in a philosophical intellectual context. Mm-hmm. If you talk to folks like the Dalai Lama or the Pope or any of these folks, they will say, or my good friend Bill Drayton over at Ashoka, they will all say that the key to the future is to be kind. And it's not about being kind to folks thousands of miles away. It's about being kind to our neighbor. So if we want to change the world, as Gandhi himself said, we actually need to change ourselves. And so the change that we're hoping, whether it's in climate change or social justice, doesn't start in Washington. It actually starts in our own hearts. Mm-hmm. And when folks realize that, they realize they have their agency. And when we realize we have agency, we realize that we can actually effect change because we can change ourselves and we can change our immediate surroundings. Mm-hmm. And that will in turn change the world.
Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, it's such a powerful message. It's a timeless message. And it's a mess, but it's also a message that I think like moderns have a difficult time with, because our mentality in modernity is, let's just move around stuff in the external world and that'll fix everything. There's not as much as the notion of the deep internal work and internal development and transformation that's necessary to even see and feel the kinds of things you need to in order to be motivated to fix the most important problems in the first place.
I can't be kind or compassionate to my neighbor unless I start with being kind and compassionate to myself. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that requires, you know, that requires what I often say are the big five. It requires, am I getting enough rest? It requires, am I eating right? Am I reducing the level of anxiety in my life? Am I meditating? And am I eating right? And we know from our work with the scientific study of Buddhist monks that meditation, and actually it was a Harvard University study that recently proved this, that meditation actually can grow the gray matter of one's brain.
Right.
And we know from, and I highly recommend the book, Arianna Huffington's book on the sleep revolution. And she wrote a very important book on, goes into great detail on what's the impact of not getting enough rest. And not getting enough rest impacts every aspect of our being. And it's actually the number one determinant of how long we're going to live. It trumps genes, it trumps diet, it trumps smoking, it trumps exercise, because it's in that rest that we actually allow, and it's in that rest and reflection that allows the deepest thoughts and the deepest aspects of ourselves to come to the surface. Mm-hmm. So that's all really, really, really important that we do that. We live in a very noisy society. Between social media has an incredibly detrimental effect on the mental health of our nation's kids. Mm-hmm. I would say the thing that I am most proud of, probably might be the most proud of in terms of, I mean, I've had the good fortune of being involved in many social justice issues. I would say I may think that the greatest contribution I helped get off the ground or continue to support is Nancy Lublin's crisis text line. And the crisis text line, because kids text, they don't use the phone. The crisis text line is a major advance in the social sector that addresses the mental health issues of our nation's kids. In the United States, the average teenager today has as much anxiety as the average inpatient psychiatric patient of the 1950s. And that's worth saying again, right?
Yeah, so, let's take a 2-second pause and then have you say that again. Because wow.
It's stunning, right? The average teenager today, so when you're walking down the street and you see teenagers, if it was 1950, those kids would be institutionalized. That's how much stress and anxiety they have. The crisis text line actually sends emergency responders to about 15 American homes a day where kids are in the process of committing suicide. Wow. They took another 80 off the ledge from committing suicide every day in this country. And so, you know, we have, you know, again, I will criticize my own generation. I actually think my own generation, again, in not being kind and not being compassionate and not being thoughtful and mindful enough to the next generation is actually partly responsible and maybe wholly responsible for the challenges that our children face today. And I want to rail against some right-wing commentators who often talk about a pampered generation, and they talk about an entitled generation. And, you know, one of the best...
They've been coddled. They lack resilience and...
Exactly. And yeah. And the counter to that is a very important philosophical value, which is that all people have value. And it's interesting that it shows up in one of the most, I think, important movies of our time, which is the documentary around Mr. Rogers. And it's Mr. Rogers...
Rachel and I just saw it last week. Yeah.
And it's Mr. Rogers who reminded us really at the height of consumerism that, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, that all children matter. And also his message was inclusive. And I probably will say it's worth pausing on that, because that actually may be one of the most important things that's ever come across my desk. And it has to do with Pope Francis. And it also has to do with Carl Sandburg. So Carl Sandburg in the early 1960s was on live television, and it was a PBS special, and he was being interviewed. And during the interview, he was asked, "Mr. Sandburg, what is the ugliest word in the English language?" And Carl Sandburg paused and he reflected, and he said, after a pause, so the ugliest word in the English language is exclusion. And I may take that thought and combine it with something that Pope Francis talks about. And Pope Francis is the first, I've had the honor of working with him and working with the Vatican on impact investing issues. And Pope Francis actually has a whole theology around sinfulness in the 21st century, which essentially says the only time we actually engage in sinful behavior is when we exclude a part of ourselves or another human being. And so it's a really easy handiwork for thinking about and judging one's behavior. And I talk about it all the time. You don't have to study moral theology. You don't even have to know the Ten Commandments. You don't have to know any of that. All you have to think about is, in what I'm doing right now, am I being inclusive or exclusive? If I'm being inclusive, the behavior is probably good. If I'm being exclusive, I should probably check that. I should probably take a look at what am I doing, because I'm probably doing something that, number one, is not good, and number two, it's not what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And so that frame of inclusivity, I think, and exclusivity is really, really important. It's one of the reasons why your generation and the millennial generation is so important, because I mentioned earlier that global consciousness. That global consciousness, by definition, indicates that when I'm thinking about things, I'm thinking about everybody. I'm thinking about an inclusive worldview.
Yeah.
And that's the only way we're going to solve the world's problems. And it's the only way we're actually going to have a peaceful globe, a productive globe. And it's the only way actually that we're actually going to be individually happy.
Mm-hmm. So like 9 things that I wanted to respond to and pick up on there. There was so much packed in there. Just a couple of things. I mean, this point about the first truly global generation. This is where technology is so interesting, because in some ways it's like you can't help but grow up with something like a global consciousness today. And actually, I think that maybe that's one reason that we live in such a culture of outrage and, you know, conflict, and the culture wars have flared so hard because now everybody's talking to everybody else.
But they're not looking at everybody.
They're not.
And this is where philosophy has the answer, in the sense that it's really easy for me to flame you in social media, via email, via social media, when I'm not looking at you. Mm-hmm. And Immanuel Levinas, the great Jewish philosopher of the 20th century, who's trying to make sense of the Holocaust, right? He's trying to make sense of this Holocaust. And he says he has a whole, his whole philosophy is really the profound nature, the profundity of looking at another human face. And it's that human face. He says that it's the simplicity of the human face. The human face is all around us. We run into human faces in everything we do. But do we take the time to really look at the complexity and the profoundness of what's behind that face? And he goes on to say that when I look at your face and when I see your face, it's really hard for me to do things that are not consistent with the human ethos. Hmm. And so I'm one of those. I spent 25 years in Silicon Valley. I did 4 startups. I always like to remind folks that every startup I ever worked at was founded by someone not born in the United States. So for all those folks who are anti-immigrant, I just want to say, as the son of immigrants and as someone who's actually really had a blessed life because of those immigrants, it's really important to recognize that a lot of people don't realize, for example, that Steve Jobs was Syrian. His father was Syrian. Right. So that's like this whole Silicon Valley is built upon folks that are not from the United States. 40% of our engineers, actually.
Well, and Elon is from South Africa, right?
Elon Musk is from South Africa. Peter
Thiel. Which is why he can't run for president, unfortunately.
And Pierre Omidyar was born in France of Persian Iranian parents. So... Mm-hmm. So it's really important to recognize that some of the most incredibly innovative folks that I ever had the opportunity to work with, Rajiv Dutta, for example, born in India, mm-hmm. Really great leader, some of the greatest leaders I've had the privilege of working with over the course of my blessed career, were born outside the United States. Mm-hmm. And that productivity is actually, and that innovation is really, really, really important. Technology is a good thing, but like any tool, can be used for both good or bad. And that's what we have to keep in mind. And we have to remember that the development of humanity takes much longer than the development of technology.
Yes.
So we have this delta right now between who we are as human beings and how far technology is advancing. Mm-hmm. You know, with like artificial intelligence and the next generation, and people are very concerned about that. I'll point out again, another great book, The Rational Optimist by Matthew Ridley. And Ridley takes a historical view of how nearly every generation thought that whatever new technology was emerging at the time would result in massive unemployment, massive dislocation, et cetera, et cetera. And we have this incredible human spirit that develops. And again, even on that point, I can see the future in my women in the ghettos of Calcutta, who are literally using in their digital services jobs artificial intelligence for major corporations around the world. And it's actually creating jobs. So for those of you who think artificial intelligence is going to be the doom and gloom of the future, I'll say, no, there's a good future out there, and it's being developed. Again, it's being developed in the developing world. Mm-hmm. The good news is, as I spend much more time in reflection and working locally, particularly in my beloved city of New Orleans, that iMerit, which is out of Calcutta, is actually just created 100 digital service jobs for disadvantaged folks in New Orleans. And so you will see much more of this type of economic development in the United States. You will see this development in poorer communities, and you will see this development with Americans who have been left behind. And mm-hmm. so we have left Americans behind, right? I tell everyone that Donald Trump is not an aberration. We all created him. And the way we move forward is by recognizing our own individual culpability, mine included, in creating a world that actually allowed him to emerge. And it really gets back to what I think Ryan Stevenson said, which is we need to be proximate. We need to change the narrative. We need to be hopeful. and we need to make ourselves uncomfortable. We have to understand our fellow Americans. I spend a lot of time talking to Trump voters. I have Trump voters in my family. I think we all do. And understanding, you know, where are they coming from? And they're coming from, they're good people. Arlie Hochschild wrote that great book, Strangers in Their Own Land. And she went to, in writing that book, she went to Lafayette, Louisiana, which is where my husband was born, in Lafayette, Louisiana. And I often say there's a lot of really good people in Lafayette. She actually went to Lake Charles, but which is right outside Lafayette. And what she found was she built friendships with incredible people across the aisle. And that's where, again, Levinas comes back.
Yeah.
Because Levinas reminds us that I can't condemn that face in front of me. I have to engage that face in front of me. And I might say Pierre Hadot, you and I both share a fondness for Pierre Hadot, the great French philosopher of the 20th century. And Hadot reminds us that the precondition for virtue is probably politeness. That you actually can't exercise courage. You cannot exercise prudence. You cannot exercise any of the virtues without the precursor condition of politeness, which means that I have to be present and listen to you. If I start condemning, I think the challenge of social media is that it's easy to flame. Once I flame you, once I condemn you on social media, we're no longer engaged in human interaction, and a blame game is underway, and nothing is moving forward. It is my caution to Democrats, and it's my caution to Republicans. At some point, one of these sides will have to say, enough is enough. And we're not going to engage in tactics of flaming and blaming, but we're going to engage actually truly in what leadership is about, which is kindness, building and raising. My partner's grandmother had a very famous, and I always tell folks, the wisdom of grandmothers, had a very famous line which she said, lift them up. And they're all we do, lift them up. And again, that kind of gets to the Pope's inclusive and exclusive. In everything I'm doing, am I lifting you up or am I tearing you down? If I'm lifting you up, let's continue. If I'm tearing you down, I should pause. And that's why technology, social media, confrontation, if the human person is in front of me, I'm looking at you right now. In looking at you right now, I treat you differently than if we were just having an email conversation. And that's probably one of the things when I coach organizations or when I work in organizational development, I try to figure out how are the folks, I'm working with an organization right now on this, how do they communicate with one another? And email is a terrible form of communication. I'm old enough to remember, telegrams. And so an email is essentially a telegram. There's no context. For those of you who remember telegrams, and telegrams used to pay by the word and the letter. And so you would drop out articles, you drop out punctuation, you would just have what would be called a stop. Right. And you would go to the next line. And you didn't have to pay for that stop. And so email is just like a telegram. There's no context. There's no humanity to an email. And in fact, I would also argue in the corporate sector, it undermines both accountability and responsibility, because most people use email as a CYA for their bosses or for their whatever they're trying to do.
Well, and we hate email.
That's right.
Because there's so much of it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the garbage that you just have to take out every day. It's already people are already predisposed negatively when they're receiving an email.
That's right. And that's a very good point, that the spirit, where's my spirit when I receive an email? And it almost feels like an intrusion.
Right.
Here's a fun fact for you though on email. Between it's at least 50 and it's as high as 70% of all issues that are raised in the corporate world in email self-resolve. Like you're participating in the email chain or the email conversation actually doesn't advance the issue. You don't have to. The issue will self-resolve.
So it's just a waste.
It's just a waste of time.
Yeah. So there's, again, probably like 7 or 8 things we could go into. But I imagine listeners are wondering, you've alluded to your career and your work to some extent. But when you are on an airplane, people ask you, what do you do? How do you typically respond?
I usually say that I'm a human capital expert who was trained in philosophy and theology. And I will say, once you say you're trained in philosophy and theology, you know, the first question you get is the first question your parents probably asked you, David, when you would tell them you were doing philosophy, which is, so what are you going to do with that? Right. Or like, how do you eat? Right. How are you sitting next to me on this plane?
Yeah. Well, I was lucky. My parents were unique, maybe, or unusual. They did not ask me that. What I remember is them saying, I remember my dad yelling when I was driving out the driveway to go back to school after I declared a major, and he said, "Become a philosopher." But yeah, that's the typical response.
Right. That's right. And that's something that's a great blessing that you had that support, because your parents implicitly there are saying, follow your passion. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. We tend to forget that. Malcolm Gladwell, you know, wrote about this when he said, you know, when he had that famous 10,000 hours. And you create a flywheel of development. In my generation of organizational development and executive coaching, the old view was that, you know, you had these good strengths, great, and let's focus on your weaknesses and eliminate your weaknesses. And the modern, based on some of the research that folks like Gladwell did, we remind us that actually that's not the approach. The best approach for senior leaders is actually to double down on your success, double down on what you're good at. That's how you can do something for 10,000 hours. It creates that flywheel of the things that I'm interested in are the things that I tend to be good at. And the things that I tend to be good at, I tend to spend a lot of time at. And that creates that excellence. And so finding your passion and your excellence is really, really important, because it's in that passion and excellence, nearly every passion and excellence that you get to that aspect of excellence will have its ability for self-sustaining. And then what we really realize with executive leaders is that you can't eliminate your constructive behaviors, the behaviors that take you away from your true self. But if you're mindful of them and you minimize those behaviors, then you're fine. And you want to focus on your strengths. Each and every one of us has a backpack of baggage, right? So we each carry in our lives a backpack full of anxieties, weaknesses, and our demons, right? We have a backpack of demons that we carry with us all the time. We want to know which demons are in there, and we want to make peace with them. But we have to remember the demons never go away. They're there. They are who we are. They're a part of our very being. We just don't want them to come out and dominate us.
Embrace the shadow.
Exactly. Make peace.
Acknowledge it. Embrace it. I love the – have you ever heard the tea with Mara idea from Tara Brach, the Buddhist teacher?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. I love it. It's a very evocative image that encapsulates the idea you just articulated. It's the story of the Buddha when he started teaching after his enlightenment. And Mara, the lord of death, the personification of all of our anxieties and the darker aspects of human nature, Mara would come and sort of lurk on the periphery of the field where he was teaching. And the way she puts it is the Buddha would say, "I see you, Mara. Let's have tea."
That's right.
You go toward the monster.
You make peace.
Yeah.
You know, you make peace with it. And that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And I like the image of you breaking bread with it. And think about that. If we can extend that to folks who, quote unquote, are our rivals or our enemies.
Right.
And that's how you have true enlightenment in society.
Right. Yeah, the parts that I fear about myself are connected in some way with the people who I oppose as my rivals or the them.
And by the way, that's not pie in the sky, right? Because the Buddha inspired Ashoka, and Ashoka did create a political state based on Buddhist principles that thrived in ancient India.
Mm-hmm.
And so these things are possible, right? They're absolutely possible. So when folks say, "Oh, that's pie in the sky," you can't do that. We actually can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this idea that the way that you talk about human development is, I think, it's a way of communicating it to people who might otherwise dismiss that as pie in the sky, as you say, or woo woo. In other words, if we treat internal development as seriously as we treat external development, that there is a sort of logic. There are truths that we know about the human spirit and how it develops and how it gets stuck and how it works through that. And if we taught that, if we integrated that more into our education systems, into our workplaces, into our government, then that would probably make the world a lot better.
Well, if we actually unpack what education is, and we start, you know, education starts in the home. It starts with the parents. We learn, like, think about it. We every aspect of education changes ourselves. From the very beginning, when we're learning our language, whatever language we grow up in, we're learning how to speak. Sommeliers learn how to smell, and musicians learn how to hear. Artists develop this incredible sense of seeing things that we don't see, that most of us don't see. Artists are so important in our world because they are the true social critics, and they really do what Bryan Stevenson said. They both inspire us and make us uncomfortable at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's their power, and that's how they affect social change. It's why art is so, so important. If there are any government bureaucrats out there listening, please don't cut art budgets. We need art. We need play. Play is really, really, really important. We have to be playful. I tell every executive I work with, do not smother the little boy or the little girl inside you. Go out and play every day. I sometimes get asked to speak at conferences on innovation, and I always say, if you really want to see innovation, you don't need to come to Silicon Valley. Go to your local playground and watch kids play, because the way kids play is the key to innovation. You want to innovate? Act like a child. Mm-hmm. In a good way.
Mm-hmm. Childlike, not childish, right?
Childlike.
As Jesus would put it.
That's right.
Yeah. So
again, remember, think about that. Think about that wisdom of that parable that Jesus talks about. You know, mm-hmm. Become these children. He wasn't saying become childlike. He was saying become like these children, because these children have a sense of play. They have a sense of innovation. Children are incredibly optimistic. They're incredibly loving, and they're incredibly inclusive. The human person, by definition, is incredibly inclusive. And we have to teach hatred. We have to teach discrimination. We have to teach those things. We have to change our fundamental nature, which is good. As Anne Frank reminds us, right? Even as she's being hauled off to a concentration camp, her last line in her diary is, I still believe people are basically good. And she's right. And so that's why that parable is in the Gospels, right? Because it reminds us, Jesus reminds us, every major religious figure reminds us of the beauty, the optimism, the innovation, and the playfulness of children. And why, I always ask myself, why do we beat that out of ourselves? Mm-hmm. Right? We don't have to.
Yeah. When I was telling listeners how we first met, I forgot to mention that one of my first thoughts was about you was, this guy's from the future. So that... makes you
most people think I'm from the past.
Well, that makes your past interesting to know where you came from. So where did you grow up?
So I was born in Brooklyn, and really am an old New Yorker. And I spent a significant amount of time in the Bronx, Queens, Long Island. Went to high school, public high school on Long Island. Went to Columbia undergrad, and then later, through the Jesuits, found my way back to Fordham in the Bronx. Mm-hmm.
Can you paint a picture for us for what New York City was like back then? I mean, it I imagine is almost seems like a different world. How much things have changed, or?
Oh yes, particularly where in all those regions, right? So I remember the Bronx burning in the 1970s. Particularly in where Columbia is on the Upper West Side, Morningside Park, you couldn't go to during the day. But I would say the thing to remember, and I'm not one of these people who I believe in progress, I believe in the future, I do not believe New York City. I believe New York City is better today than it was back then. The Apollo was shuttered when I was in college. 125th Street was mostly derelict, and the subway cars rarely was there an air-conditioned subway car. There was, and actually the subway cars were completely covered in graffiti. Now I know people complain about the system, and I know Governor Cuomo has declared an emergency, and I'm like, I get on those subways and I'm like, if y'all only knew what it was like 30 years ago.
So growing up, did you have an intellectual awakening? Was there a favorite book? Was there a favorite teacher? How did you start kind of along your path?
You know, I would say that I was, if there's any theme, it really started with my grandparents. My grandfather on my mother's father was born and raised in Italy. In fact, all four of my grandparents were born and raised, not just in Italy, were born in Sicily. Mm-hmm. My grandfather and my father was born and raised in Sicily. And my grandfather on my mother's side, I remind my family of this. He was a day laborer. He worked on the docks. He was a longshoreman, and he would be at the docks in New York, and he would hope that he'd get that tap on the shoulder for work that day. And I remind folks today, we see a lot of immigrants, Spanish-speaking immigrants from all over Latin America. And they're on the corners. People will see them on corners. And whenever I drive by and I see those young men, mostly men, waiting on the corner for work, whoever's in the car with me, I remind them that was my grandfather. And it's really important to remember that. It grounds me. And my grandfather, and this is something amazing about the developing world. Folks who have so little share so much. And it's really extraordinary. My grandfather, when I was growing up in the Bronx, he lived in the Bronx, and I used to spend my summers in the Bronx as a kid. Probably the only kid on Long Island who would actually go to the Bronx for summer vacation. They were magical times because that house was always open. And I try to encourage that myself, that standard of being in service. I always tell folks in New Orleans, if the shutters are open, come on in. And I always have a full bar because we celebrate everything in New Orleans, and a full fridge, a full stock fridge, because when you come in, you should eat and drink. And there's something about that, you know, if we go back again to the ancient world, the defining relationship of society in the ancient world was that guest-host relationship, that guests would show up and that you would host them. And, you know, people think that the sin in Leviticus is around sexual impropriety. It's mm-hmm. actually the sins in Leviticus are around a violation of that guest host relationship.
Right. Is that in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah as well? Correct.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually this prime relationship, which still exists in the developing world, which is, you know, people are traveling and people will show up on your door. And I love New Orleans for this. It's the only city in America where this occurs. It occurs in other places all over the world. But New Orleans is the only place it truly occurs in the United States, where you will drink champagne on your front stoop with total strangers. And you will welcome them into your house. And New Orleans is one of the few places in America where we still have shared experiences. One of the challenges of the echo chamber world is that we don't have shared experiences with people who are different from ourselves. Mm-hmm. I ask, you know, and I'm technically a liberal elite, coastal elite, because of the good fortune I've had in my life. And I remind my fellow coastal elites, and I ask this one question: when was the last time you broke bread or had a drink with a working class American? Because mm-hmm. that's how you understand who they are and where they're coming from.
Be proximate.
Be proximate. And I have across the street from me in New Orleans, because it's a poor city. We tend to think about income inequity in this country at the individual level, and we forget to think about it at the corporate level. With one foot in San Francisco, San Francisco may be the wealthiest city in history. The annual budget of San Francisco is $11.2 billion. The annual budget of New Orleans is $610 million, and we have more kids in the public schools in New Orleans. That is the aspect of income inequity that needs to be addressed in the United States. It's not just at the individual level. It's not taxing the rich. but it's actually thinking through resources and thinking through wealthy communities and what is the responsibility of wealthy communities and wealthy cities for those less fortunate. Mm-hmm. And I use those two extremes because they're extreme, and I have a foot in both of them. Mm-hmm. But we have it in Cherry Hill and Camden, New Jersey. We have it across the bridge in St. Louis. We have it all over this country. Mm-hmm. And you know, as the Gospels remind us, to those who much has been given, much will be expected. And mm-hmm. we can't forget that's where, if we want to change the narrative in the country, be proximate and look at our neighbor. Mm-hmm. And that's where rural America, I think, is often also unfairly criticized. Mm-hmm. Because in rural America, there's an incredible sense of community. There's an incredible sense of helping your neighbor. There's an incredible sense in rural America. I had the good fortune of spending a lot of time in Nebraska during my career. I used to spend 3 months a year in the early days of PayPal in Nebraska, mm-hmm. 1 week a month every month. And Nebraskans are good people. They're really, really good people. And they leave their doors unlocked and they care about their communities.
Yeah,
and
that's where
and they're being devastated by an opioid epidemic that the coastal elites are not addressing.
Yeah, that's where my wife's father is from originally.
Oh, where?
Omaha.
Oh, yeah, Omaha's a great city. Yeah. It's a great Midwestern city. Again, coastal elites, we have to stop mischaracterizing our neighbors. I get it a lot now, as particularly, you know, when people look at my license and see that I have a Louisiana driver's license. They're like, you know, like they immediately start categorizing me, you know, mm-hmm. as who's non-intelligent, someone who must be racist if I'm a white person from Louisiana, you know. So it's really, really interesting how, again, if coastal elites want to change the world, we have to change ourselves. We have to as Emmanuel Levinas reminds us, do I really see my neighbor?
Yeah. I wonder too, just listening to you thinking this over, if this, you know, this sort of disdain or condescension toward folks in so-called flyover states that, you know, liberal elites have or, you know, are said to have, I wonder if that, to the extent that it's there, is it unconsciously a product of envy? In the sense that, like, that sense of neighborliness, that sense of openness, and like you said before, right, less well-off folks share a lot.
That's right. That's right.
Is there maybe an almost conscious or unconscious felt lack of that in the lives of quote unquote successful, busy, you know, very well educated, financially well off, liberal elites that they almost wish they had? You know, in other words, they consciously think they know they have it so much better, but their busy micromanaged lives, like, don't necessarily have enough openness and connection to their local communities. I never thought of that way before, but just the way you were describing it made me make that connection, if that connection holds.
You just stated why I love Louisiana, why I live in New Orleans, right? Which is, I can't walk the dog at night without it becoming a 1 hour walk, a 15 minute walk becomes an hour, because you never know who you're going to run into. Every time I'm in New Orleans, I have pop-up parties. Like, I don't plan a party, but a party emerges. and the sense of community is really, really important. I'm really good friends as family with my neighbors across the street. Two of my best friends of all time bought the house behind us in New Orleans. And we're going to all grow old together. You know,
that
and
is living, awesome.
Living in community. And, you know, when you talk about the elites, I have to come back to one of the great things that I had the good fortune of studying as a philosopher is the study of happiness. And most studies about happy and unhappy are actually faulty in their methodology, where you basically have a group of elites with a group of categories saying, this is what makes people happy, you know, access to jobs, access to healthcare, low crime, all that sort of stuff. And those things are important. I'm not saying they're not important.
And are you talking about, like, psychologists?
Well, you know, like, the best cities in the world to live in, you know, the best places to work, the best places to live. The methodology is faulty when it comes to happiness. People equate that characterization that if you have these categories, that's the best place to live or work. And so that's why you have, our culture fixated on the wealth creation that takes place in the coasts. But when you actually move, and this is building on your comment, when you actually ask people in self-reported studies of happiness, guess the two unhappiest states in the United States.
California and New York.
That's right. Exactly. 49 and 50 in self-reported happiness. Now guess the number one state in the United States, which also has the five top happiest cities in the United States.
Idaho.
Louisiana. So in self-reported happiness, Louisianans, and I always tell folks, most people think of New Orleans as Bourbon Street, mm-hmm. which is really, you know, self-medication, right? You have these coastal elites coming to Bourbon Street to self-medicate. But in reality, Louisiana and New Orleans is about that community. Mm-hmm. And it's about it's about saying hello. You know, there was my partner always makes fun of me here in Provincetown or when I'm in Boston or New York or San Francisco, because I'll walk down the street and I say hello to everybody. And there's actually this wonderful article written in the New York Times about 5 or 10 years ago, maybe longer, about a gentleman who said hello to everybody in Boston, and no one said hello back. But he pointed to a study that showed that, again, coming back to Emmanuel Levinas, that level of connection, one human being to another human being, could influence a human being to not commit suicide, which is why he said hello to everybody on the street. And then practicing kindness. And those two things, we also know from scientific data, actually change the dopamine patterns in our brain. Mm-hmm. And actually make us feel better. And mm-hmm. so those sorts of things, and that's where I think why that's, to me, the hook of philosophy. The hook of philosophy is the ability to live life better, right? And then that, for me, that's the purpose of what we do. Mm-hmm. And then to share that, to share anything I know with my fellow human person.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the Dalai Lama. If you want to make others happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion.
Right, exactly. Right. Exactly. Good fortune of working with the Tibetans for a couple of years, actually. Mm-hmm. And I will say, one of the things I'm proud of is I was the first Westerner with a group, including, and this is where I'm grateful to Pierre and Pam Omidyar. They invited me on a trip to Dharamsala, and we were the first Westerners to ever actually have a meal and His Holiness's kitchen.
And when was this?
Probably about 4 or 5 years ago, 2013, I want to say.
Yeah. Wow. So this was with Pierre and Pam and...
Arianna Huffington was on that trip. I became good friends with Arianna on that trip. Mm-hmm. Nicholas Bergerwin, who actually has the Philosophy Prize.
He was That's on that right. Trip. Yeah.
And he is a philosopher, and he uses... He's a great example of someone who uses philosophy for social change in a real, mm-hmm. in a very real sense, by also encouraging the whole discipline.
Mm-hmm. So, and it was the Dalai Lama and some of his attendants, or
at lunch, yes. Okay. And then we were on retreat, and really, I was doing some work in entrepreneurship with the Tibetans and trying to help. The Tibetan, basically Tibetan entrepreneurship but development. And that trip eventually led me to also work with the Tibetans. I went to Bayle Kupe, which is it's one of the famous Tibetan refugee camps. There still are Tibetan refugee camps across mm-hmm. India that are essentially refugee camps that have become settlements within India. Mm-hmm. And that's also a great example.
And that's from when they fled.
From 1959.
Wow.
And, you know, it's a great example. You know, again, a poor country like India, I think it's a great example for the whole world, where in 1959, you know, tens of thousands, you know, there's a couple hundred thousand Tibetans living in exile. And they were welcomed into India, a poor country. Nehru welcomed them. And I think that's important when we look at the crisis of refugees today. Mm-hmm. Today we have more refugees than we've ever had in human history. And it is one of the three stated objectives of Pope Francis's papacy, which is number one is around climate change. Number two is around inclusive economic development. And number three is around refugees. And he's really focusing the church and all the resources of the Catholic Church on those three issues. And it's great to see Pope Francis leading, frankly, leading the charge, both intellectually, philosophically, theologically, and frankly, politically, for social justice on these issues. He is by far one of the most important figures, along with, I would say, folks like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, for social change in the world today.
Yeah.
All the major faiths. I have to call out the Aga Khan. The Aga Khan, which represents 25% of all Shiites in the world today, doing the most amazing work in East Africa, Somalia, Pakistan. The Aga Khan was preaching the equality of men and women. Most Americans don't know this, but the Ishmaelites branch of the Shiite faith in Islam has been preaching the radical equality of men and women for centuries before the West. And so, again, like anything, Americans have a far too simplistic view of the world, right? Mm-hmm. And you can understand that psychologically because we have to categorize things and we don't often have the time to really to dive into detail.
Right.
But the complexity of folks like the Aga Khan and the Aga Khan's work that has been profound and is cutting edge in social change for centuries. The Aga Khan traces, he's an imam and he traces his lineage directly to Muhammad. So really, really powerful spiritual leaders like the Aga Khan, like the Pope, like His Holiness, all of whom essentially lead the three major faiths of the world, doing incredible things.
In our earlier correspondence, you mentioned that you've met with Francis before.
Yeah. At the first impact investing conference organized at the Vatican under the Peace and Justice Institute, headed by Cardinal Turkson, who is an amazing cardinal from Ghana.
Yeah, he actually came and spoke at Boston College 3 years ago now, I think it was, right when Laudato Si was coming out to speak about the Vatican's efforts around climate change. So yeah, he was really powerful.
Yeah, he's actually pretty amazing. He's one of the most amazing leaders that I've had the good fortune of getting to know. And he very courageous in his work and in driving the entire Curia to use the resources of the Church on behalf, much more mindfully on behalf of social justice and the less fortunate.
Yeah. I'm wondering about you've worked with so many leaders from different sectors, kinds of organizations. And I'm wondering, I'd like to hear more about the Dalai Lama and Pope Francis. One thing that I've heard people say who've met them in person, and I think one thing that is clear just from observing them is energetically, they have a kind of inner freedom. There's a kind of buoyancy. There's a kind of humor. There's an easy gentleness and compassion that kind of wafts off of them.
They play.
They play.
That's what I was talking about. Yeah, yeah. What we were talking about earlier. They have a sense of play. The Dalai Lama may have the best laugh I've ever heard. I mean, his laugh. When the Dalai Lama laughs, he laughs with his entire body.
Yeah.
It's an amazing, amazing laugh. It reverberates. And, you know, when we laugh, you know, don't hold back. Don't hold back. And Pope Francis, I think, again, that positivity. Pope Francis is both positive and humble. So when you meet Pope Francis, he will not let anyone kiss his ring, nor will he let anyone bow in front of him.
Yeah. And no fancy shiny red shoes.
No fancy apartments. Right. He lives with his Jesuit community.
Yeah.
And he eats in the cafeteria. Right. So very, very powerful, profound. He's the first pope in history to wash the feet of women on Holy Thursday, right? So really, really important stuff. And again, the march towards inclusivity will continue, right? It will continue in the church, in my opinion. may not be in our lifetime. Remember, the church is 2,000 years old, right? So it may take a little longer than we would like to see. But as long as it's moving in the right direction, I'm pleased with that. There's an old expression: it's not where you're at; it's where you're headed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love, and you, and one of the things I love about your email address is you have, as you mentioned before, you have a lot of Bryan Stevenson is on there often in the quotes at the bottom. But I remember one you used to have from Pope John Paul II, which was "See everything, overlook much, change a little."
That's right. And that was John the 23rd.
Oh, John the 23rd. Okay.
Which is classic Italian, right? Mm-hmm. It's a classic Italian, right? Which is, you know, see everything, but like, you know, and this is actually gets back to a comment. So that comment is really important, because that comment by John the 23rd, I think is an important thing to remember for today, where we have so many, what I would call microaggressions, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, where you know, like, we can't be angry at everything, right? If you really think about it, there's a lot to be angry with everywhere. And so what I try to encourage people for their own sanity is pick one or two things that really, really upset you and try not to juggle the rest.
Yeah. And I think that the notion of, you know, taking the long view, as we talked about before, is something that's helpful here, you know, in the sense that it's easy to focus on the short term and get impatient that things are not changing along all the axes that we think they need to change. But when you look at things in the big picture, I mean, even coming back to the subway example you gave earlier about, you know, people think the subways are bad now. Well, you should have seen it, you know, back in the 60s or 70s, you know, and that's where gratitude comes in. Right?
You make a very, very important point, which, again, I think philosophy illuminates for us, which is the idea that we are obsessed as Americans with outcomes.
Yeah.
And we what we should be obsessed with is how we're behaving in the means, right? So we have a focus on the ends in popular culture. You know, did you get it done or did you not? And we're not focusing on the means of how we got there, on the journey. When we take our mind off, if we're only focusing on the ends, it'll actually just make us uptight, because then we're creating this incredible set of expectations. And those sets of expectations only lead to resentments. I often say that expectations are nothing more than premeditated resentments. So let go of those expectations and focus on showing up in the here and now in the proximate. Mm-hmm. And that's where, if you want to call yourself a person of faith, you have to give up that control for the outcome. Yeah. You have to trust that if I'm showing up and doing the right thing in the moment right now, then we can have faith that the universe or God, whatever we want to call it, will actually help us move it forward.
Yeah.
And the moment we do that, the moment we let go is the moment, and we let go so we can show up now. Again, a philosophical, theological concept that I love that guides me through the day is that whole sense of time in the eternal present, that God exists in the eternal present, and the only thing that exists is the present. The future doesn't yet exist and the past is gone. And so by focusing on that, and I think that's what your comment is getting at, right? Which is, you know, the anxiety of outcomes, as opposed to letting that go, letting all that anxiety go.
Right.
And focusing in on, how do I show up right now? There was a great gift, again, going back to one of the great politicians, Willie Brown. And this is an anecdote that is a really powerful anecdote for me. And he inspired me early in my career, because it was early in my career when I met my first husband, who's since passed on. When Michael and I were in his office, and at that time we had domestic partnership, we were getting a domestic partnership. In the middle, we had just started the ceremony. We were running a little late because Willie Brown always ran late. I ran late too. His chief of staff came in and said, "Mayor Brown," he said, "the president is on the line. President Clinton would like to speak with you." and I'll never forget this. Willie Brown looked at his chief of staff and said, "I'm in the middle of something really important here." He said, please tell the president I will call him back. And about 10 minutes later, the aide comes back and says, President Clinton is calling back again. He really needs to talk to you. And Mayor Brown said again, he said, look, I will get to the president when I'll get to the president. But this is really important because I'm here with my constituents. I'm here with the people who matter. Not that the president didn't matter, but it's my favorite story, which is jump up in the here and now. Don't worry who you're talking to, but be present and respectful in the moment. And when you are, good things will emerge. And I tell that Willie Brown anecdote because it's one of my favorite anecdotes. And it's a side of Willie Brown that a lot of folks may not know. Mm. It's that tender Willie Brown. And in fact, at the end of that ceremony, I was poor after I left the Jesuits. And so my gift to Willie Brown, our thank you gift to him, was a specially designed hat. He's famous for wearing hats from his hat shop. I was able to figure out his hat shop. And the thing about that hat was there was the thing about hats is actually not what you see, but the value of a hat is the lining inside the hat. And this particular hat had lining from East Africa. It was an East African lining that was actually handmade by folks in Kenya, another beautiful country. And when he saw that, he started crying. I tell those stories because Willie Brown is one of those great examples of a politician who's, again, looking ahead, trying to create, like he created an amazing vision for San Francisco, but lived in the moment and did the right things in the moment. And it may seem as though I'm being contradictory when I talk about the long haul and the short term, but the two are in unison if you have a philosophical view of time.
Wow. So I heard some Seneca woven in there. I heard some Augustine woven in there, all connected with a personal anecdote. So speaking of philosophers, Sal, how did philosophy hook you?
Well, I think it was the ideas embedded in philosophy, and it was a framework and a tool that helped me and continues to help me do my inner work. You know, I always tell folks, it is a journey. There is no destination. You know, life is a travel. We're all traveling together. Mm-hmm. And when we can have moments of shared communion, wow, isn't that just great? Mm-hmm. And we can meet fellow travelers. I have a quote at home about from Dr. Seuss about that says, you know, we're all a little weird. And along our journey, we meet other people who are a little weird. And when our weirdness matches up and is accepted fully, then we know we're in love. And so that's I think philosophy allows us to explore. It's why I love New Orleans. New Orleans is full of eccentric, crazy people. I think philosophy gave me the courage to be myself. And I wrote this to you earlier. Everything I think does go back to Socrates for the West, you know, the founder of Western philosophy. And I think he's, I don't want to be disrespectful to Socrates. I might say he's a little incomplete because he said, know thyself. And I would add, be thyself. So it's one thing. I think when we really are engaged in reflection, we can figure out and know who we are, but we need courage to be who we are. And being who we are often separates us from the herd and the crowd, which is truly what Nietzsche was talking about. Nietzsche, in my opinion, was a great philosopher, and he's terribly misunderstood, in my opinion. But he's encouraging us to be thyself. He's encouraging us, and with cost, he recognizes that when you're yourself, you may make other people uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and that may lead to rejection, which means that you really have to have that inner work done. Because without that inner work done, you will be made sad. Mm-hmm. And so it's really
become who you are, right?
Become who you are.
So in a way, that's the. And it's interesting you frame it this way, because the Socratic adage is "know thyself," and Nietzsche was partly attacking Socrates as being too rational, too cognitively oriented, not enough in touch with the body and the emotions and the wild and what cannot be fully grasped and framed, because life is too messy, too unpredictable.
You have to learn how to play, you have to learn how to dance.
That summary. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the difficult, murky world of the emotional domain. Of breaking through those fears. So, yeah.
And it's okay to be inconsistent, because that's where growth comes in. You know, mm-hmm. none of us have the idea. I hope none of us, you know, have the ideas that we had when we were 12. They develop and they deepen. And just like our faith deepens, our faith changes over time. We change over time. And you can point out inconsistencies, you know, in our thinking. But that's what Nietzsche's getting at, is that messiness. And Carl Jung picks up on Nietzsche, you know, the great psychologist, where he says, we cannot know thyself. We cannot know ourselves without having looked at the abyss of ourselves first. Mm-hmm. And we have to literally go through that abyss.
Yeah. Well, and that chaos, that those contradictions, that that's tension, right. that, you know, when that is engaged rather than repressed, that's the engine, that's the energy of growth and transformation.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, life is chaos, right? It's a set of chaos. And we try to make sense of it as best we can.
Yeah. You turned to philosophy, and you had additional majors in college, is that right? At Columbia?
My undergraduate major was a double major in economics and political science at Columbia. And then mm-hmm. the Columbia program is basically a great books program the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then I loaded up on theology in my senior year. And I think I was one course or two courses short of a minor. Mm-hmm. I almost pulled off the minor, but wanted to graduate.
mm-hmm. How did you find your way from there to the Jesuits?
Was definitely had the service bug in me and was thinking about how to really contribute and change the world. Mm-hmm. And so I thought the legal profession would be a great way of doing that. And so I went to Notre Dame Law School. And at Notre Dame, I was both in the law school and I was in a master's program in theology. And I was there had a conversation about this with the then president, Teddy Hesburgh. And Father Hesburgh was truly an amazing, amazing leader. Roots in the civil rights movement. I mean, just a true, a great social. He was a Holy Cross father, great priest, and was questioning. He wanted to make sure that I was not too distracted from law with theology. And when I was studying my theology, I ran into Jerry McCool, and took Jerry McCool's class. And it had a conflict. The class he was teaching, he was a visiting scholar mm-hmm. at Notre Dame, and like myself. It's hard to categorize people like Jerry McCool or Bernard Lonergan, Vinnie Potter or Vinnie O'Keefe or Vinnie or even myself, because we straddle both philosophy and theology. Mm-hmm. In the modern concept, in the ancient world, we'd be philosophers. But in the modern world, we're classified as both philosophers and theology. The theologians are straddling both. The class that Jerry McCool was teaching was on 19th century theology, and it conflicted with a mandatory course that the Holy Cross seminarians had to take. So there were only three of us in the class. And I got to know Jerry very, very well. And I was in an office hour with him, and he was asking me this question about what I was going to do with my life. And Jerry became my spiritual director. And he said to me, he said, you know, Sal, he said, the church does not need good attorneys. And in this wider sense of church, he said, the church needs good priests. And he invited me to think about the Jesuits. Well, I dropped out of law school after 1 year, or dropped out of Notre Dame after 1 year, and entered the Jesuits that fall, and had the opportunity to then study even more deeply with Jerry and his little band of folks like Norrie Clark and Vinnie Potter and Vinnie O'Keefe and Robert J. O'Connell and Quentin Lauer. I mean, in my opinion, and Avery Dulles, Cardinal Avery Dulles, in my opinion, some of the greatest minds of the 20th century.
And this was at Fordham.
This was at Fordham.
Would this be the 80s?
Yes, it would be the late 80s. Yeah, the late 80s. Okay. You know, I am good friends with Joe McShane, the president of Fordham, because when I was a Jesuit novice, he was a young Jesuit priest at Le Moyne College, and
That's right.
We came back then. And Joe McShane again is one of these incredible great leaders, civic leader. University presidents used to be civic leaders, or part of our civic institutions that were leading and creating institutions for all people. And one of the things I love about Fordham, I'm an advisor on the graduate school there and the advisory board there, and is that Fordham has maintained its commitment to educating immigrants and the children of immigrants, and maintains that social justice commitment.
Absolutely.
And just a special shout out to Fordham. I'm about to criticize, and so I'm going to say I apologize in advance if I make any NYU graduates upset. But one of the great things that a lot of people don't realize is that NYU started in the Bronx. And when the Bronx was having its social challenges in the 60s and 70s, starting in the late 50s, they abandoned the Bronx. And that's why NYU is in Lower Manhattan. Fordham stayed in the Bronx. Fordham had that same decision to make. Do we stay in the Bronx, or like NYU, do we go to greener pastures?
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed in the Bronx. They made a commitment to that community, to that neighborhood, and to those neighborhoods actually surrounding Fordham. And it's a great, in my opinion, is I asked myself, would institutions today make that same choice and that same decision? I think Joe McShane and Fordham would. And I'm very proud of that affiliation with Fordham, because Fordham, again, not just philosophy, but as Marianne Williamson says, mindfulness is mental masturbation if it does not follow with action on behalf of the less fortunate. And Fordham did that. And so I am very proud of that affiliation with Fordham. And again, I apologize to anyone who's upset by my remarks about NYU, but I think NYU engaged in cowardice behavior.
Yeah, well, Joe McShane is a force of nature. I was fortunate enough to meet him personally when I was at Fordham, but every year he does a worldwide now tour to fundraise for Fordham, and has these alumni gatherings. And so I've gone, Rachel and I have gone the last couple of years.
Oh, excellent.
And I told her, I said, we're going, like, because it'll be fun and we'll meet some of the alumni and, give a little money back to the school. But, like, I want you to hear Joe McShane. I want you to experience Joe McShane.
Yeah.
And she went and she was like, oh my God, like, I want to give money to Fordham now. I didn't even go there.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll tell you too, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen him engage a crowd with such passion and intensity and humor and specificity, both talk about really big economic and social and political issues, but also do it in a perfectly down-to-earth and authentic way. I mean, it's a real charism.
It is the Jesuit ideal, and I go back to St. Ignatius, who again, it's a nice weaving into some of your earlier questions, which is the ideal for St. Ignatius was that you would, you would both work in the academy, but also when you were done working with the academy, you would go serve on the streets. You would go work with the poor on the streets. And there's a long line of Jesuits who do that. And Joe McShane, I think, really exemplifies that Jesuit ideal of, yes, I'm spending time in the academy, but I'm also going on the streets and I'm working with the people on the streets. And it's important because it's one of the challenges in the social sector. One of the challenges in the social sector is to understand that, yes, I can come up with these great theories at Harvard for economic development, but am I listening to the people on the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the organization that I'm on the board with and the Omidyar Network helped create, called the GIFT, the Global Innovation Fund, which is a multilateral public-private partnership. I represent the private sector on this board, and we have countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, Sweden, and Australia, and South Africa, all who have made significant financial contributions. And we're changing the model of foreign aid, where rather than being top down, where some new development models have been invented in the West, and then we're going to say, you're going to do it this way. We actually empower the entrepreneurs on the ground who are fighting fighting their poverty issues, and the people on the ground know best, right? The people on the ground always have a better sense of what's happening than not.
Right.
Even in military affairs, Colin Powell had this wonderful presentation in the 1990s about this topic, and he said, "You always pay attention to the people on the field. The soldiers on the field know what the conditions of battle are, and so we need to listen to them." And so, in nearly all fields, and so those principles are being used at the GIF. Very important stuff.
Well, and then once you stop doing that, then you're just touching ideas and abstractions, thinking that you're touching reality. And so the more you do that, the more you're going to become separate from the reality that you think you're actually trying to change. So you're just going to be recessing more into your own cave.
That's right.
And potentially causing more destruction than actually helping fix the problem.
That's a huge insight, what you just said. I couldn't agree more. That's exactly right. I mean, the tendency of all of us is to be armchair quarterbacks, right? It's always easy to be an armchair quarterback. Plug for the New Orleans Saints this year, while hoping to take the Super Bowl. But that's correct. It's easy to be the armchair as opposed to actually seeing the difficulties on the field.
Yeah. So while you're at Fordham, you were getting, was it an MA in philosophy?
Yes.
And
I was an EBD. I did everything but the dissertation.
Okay.
And my superiors didn't want me to write the dissertation at the time.
Yeah. I remember, but I kind of remember we met one time in New York and you were telling me about your time there and how you know, the direction that you took from getting your master's at Fordham. And am I correct in remembering that you were sort of, one path for you was becoming sort of the next great Jesuit philosopher? I remember you had recalled a conversation you had with Quentin Lauer that was very influential on your trajectory in retrospect. So could you tell us about that?
Yes. I'll tell you the two anecdotes. One is with Quentin Lauer and one is with Robert J. O'Connell. So I'll start with Robert J. O'Connell because that's the one you're actually thinking about. Robert J. O'Connell was a great Augustinian scholar. He taught Plato also at Fordham. I was taking one of his advanced courses in Augustine. And it was in the spring and he rejected my paper. And I was writing a paper talking about some aspects of Aquinas that show up in Aquinas, and you know, talking about some issues around faith and understanding, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like dumbfounded. He didn't give me a grade. He just said, "This paper is not good enough." And I'm like, "Well, what am I supposed to do?" And he said, "You're going to do a special tutorial with me over the summer." I'm like, "Oh my God." So it destroyed my summer plan. I had to stay in the Bronx in the summer, and I'm not complaining about that. I love the Bronx. And so so we did. I met with him every week, and every week I would bring in another aspect of this paper, and we would talk philosophy. And I'm like, "All right, so where do I go from here?" And so during one of these sessions with Father O'Connell, he looks at me, and apropos of nothing, he says, "Sal, would you rather be a thinker or a lover?" And here I'm thinking, all right, so, you know, I, at this point, I want to get out of this. I want him to accept my paper. I'm like, what does he want to hear?
What's the right answer?
And so I said, "Well, a thinker, you know, he's a philosopher." And Father O'Connell just looked at me and he sighed and he said, "Oh, that's really, really sad. I want you to think about that." And then we moved on, and that question stayed with me my entire life. It's the question that I continue to wrestle with. But I do know that the right answer for me, and I think the right answer for humanity, and ironically, again, I'll come back to Manuel Levinas because he helps me with this as well, is this idea that it is love. That in fact, Levinas takes it so far that he says we cannot know anything, meaning we cannot even think without a precursor of an act of love. That ties then into the work of folks like Dean Alan Jones, a great theologian at Grace Cathedral, who talks about that there are only two emotions, love and fear, and that when we do anything under the guise of the light of love, we're in the world of abundance and possibility. And when we make decisions out of fear, they're always suboptimal decisions. And it's those insights that I take to the business world all the time and remind executives that, again, I don't want to offend the attorneys and the accountants in the room, but when you make decisions, when you make important strategic decisions based on listening to the attorneys and the bean counters, they're always bad economic decisions, they're always bad business decisions. Always make good business decisions based on your convictions and values of the possibility of the future. So that was Robert J. O'Connell, and it really changed my life, and that question was with me, and it's certainly one of the reasons why I left the Jesuits, because in order to truly love, I had to leave the Jesuits.
I hope you enjoyed part one of my conversation with Sal. Be sure to check out part two next week, where we dive into his time serving as a hospital chaplain for the dying in San Francisco during the AIDS plague in the mid-90s, why he eventually left the Jesuits, including after being branded as heterodox, why he thinks the liberal arts have everything to do with the global economy, and his advice for his friend Elon Musk. If you'd like to support the podcast and help it grow, there are a number of things that you could do. First of all, you could share it with a friend or family member, a classmate or a colleague. Share it on your socials. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Or subscribe and maybe write a short review on iTunes. If you'd like to leave feedback, if there are topics you'd like to see covered, or if you'd like to recommend a guest or be a guest, drop me a line on our website, www.davidestory.com.